0.3 milligrams epinephrine in a sterile solution for injection? Sure. That'll be $600, please. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 25th of August today, Thursday. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Of all the CEO jobs in all the world to have right now, running the pharmaceutical company Mylan is probably one of the least pleasant. The company, as you have heard by now, makes EpiPens, the life-saving anti-allergy injections, a pack of two of which lists for $608. That's up from $100 less than 10 years ago. CEO Heather Bresch said on CNBC this morning that the company is going to offer rebate coupons to help people pay their out-of-pocket costs, the piece of the price tag that health insurance doesn't cover, of course. She did not, however, offer to roll back any of the price increases.
This isn't an EpiPen issue. This isn't a Mylan issue. This is a healthcare issue.
Which is technically true. Gigi Duban explains.
Mylan blames rising healthcare premiums and deductibles. But Robert Weissman, president of the watchdog group Public Citizen, says that's not it at all.
The problem is that Mylan has jacked up their price.
Since 2007, the cost of EpiPens has gone up 500%. The answer isn't to offer some patients a discount on the retail price, Weissman says. It's to cut the price.
And they're failing to do it. It's not to make insurers pay unreasonable prices, which are, of course, passed on to consumers at the end of the day anyway.
Uwe Reinhardt teaches economics at Princeton. He says 85% of healthcare premiums are driven by what doctors, hospitals, and drug makers charge. So to Mylan, he says this.
If you jack up the price by 500%, you're damn right the premium will go up. But you caused it, not the insurance company.
Mylan owns the market. For one thing, the company lobbied to get schools across the country to stock EpiPens.
If you're a company, that's the goal, right? Lock up as much business as you can.
Douglas Holtz Aiken is with the Center for Health and the Economy. He says a little competition would go a long way.
Usually what controls prices is the fact that you can't get away with raising your price. You lose your business.
But there is no competition to the EpiPen. No other company has come up with anything as effective as the company's patented injection device. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
One more thing on this story. When the inevitable congressional hearings on this start, and they surely will, things might get a little awkward in the corridors of power. Heather Bresch, the CEO of Mylan, Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, is her dad. Elsewhere in market capitalism today, you know what's worse than losing $1 million? How about losing $1 billion? Bloomberg is reporting today that Uber did just that in the first half of this year. $1.2 billion in Reading, to be precise. We got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the line to make me smart on exactly how that happened. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
$1 billion is a whole lot of American money. How does this happen?
It is a whole lot of money. And the way it happens comes down to one word, and
yes,
that word is China.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Uber would not actually confirm any of these numbers to Bloomberg. My sources close to the company did confirm, though, that most of those Q2 losses came from Uber just throwing money at the China market. In fact, if you remember, Travis Kalanick actually said in a blog post that both companies, Uber and its big competitor, Didi, had spent billions of dollars in that market. Neither were profitable. Mm-hmm. So in theory, now that Uber has pulled out of China and cut a deal with Didi in exchange for a $1 billion investment, that bleeding should be stopped, or at least significantly slowed.
Right. Theory is all well and good, but where do they go from here then?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Uber found itself in a similar situation because of the sort of hubris and competitive nature of the company. Anything that would cause you to throw that much money at China is likely to reoccur. And the company has to think about its business plan going forward. Now, the idea, of course, is that Uber will continue to grow.
Right.
And this same report suggests that's happening. The bookings are way up.
Yep.
Uber obviously wants to be able to reinvest from the places where it's profitable. Right now, its big challenge, though, is that it's locked in a battle to outspend Lyft. Both of them are paying subsidies, maybe up to $50 million a month in subsidies and ride incentives. That Lyft basically kicked off that campaign. They said they're going to cap their spending at $150 million a quarter. But Uber actually has still a giant war chest. It hopes to be able to keep outspending Lyft to get more riders and drivers until either Lyft runs out of money or gets bought.
All right, so let's pull back the curtain here a little bit. And you and I were talking the other day, as we tend to do, because this is what we do, about a theory you have about Uber and some of the other on-demand economy companies. But Uber specifically, they basically have a supply chain problem, and it's only going to get worse, and it's going to cost them $1 zillion.
That is my theory. It's not only my theory, actually. Yeah. In fact, when people question the $68 or $69 billion valuation of Uber, they say they still have to face down this driver situation. They have to get them in the door. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, Uber has gotten increasingly desperate and convoluted. So not only is it subsidizing rides, it's buying cars and leasing them to drivers. Uber is in the subprime leasing business, which all by itself poses some risk. It is still facing massive regulation, driver lawsuits, the possibility of having to classify those drivers as employees. So for every rider it gains, there's an almost equal cost on the other end. And then, of course, it's investing heavily, lots and lots of money, more billions out the door, in self-driving cars to get those drivers out of the equation. So the, I do think that the supply side remains insecure. And then on top of that, they have to maintain their quality of service throughout, because if you take a sketchy ride with somebody who just came in off the street and started driving about 2 hours ago, you don't want to use it again. So I think there are lots of good reasons to be skeptical. But if nothing else, this will not be the last billion that Uber loses.
Molly Wood, she is our senior tech correspondent. Thank you, Molly.
My pleasure.
Wall Street on this Thursday, nothing but waiting for Janet Yellen tomorrow. Big speech from the Fed chair out at the conference they're having in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Not a bad place to have a conference, I'd say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This has been a challenging year for the Republican National Committee for reasons obvious and perhaps not so obvious. The RNC is just off of one of the worst fundraising months it's had in a good couple of years. There are all kinds of reasons for that, of course, but the RNC, whose highest profile product, remember, is electing a president, is like any other business. When it's got less money coming in, there's a lot less it can do. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains what declining revenues might mean for the business of Republican politics.
National party committees help presidential candidates with things like voter registration, ads, and staff support. But this year, Republicans don't have quite as much cash in the bank to pay for it all.
They're just going to have less resources.
Bob Biersack is a senior fellow at the Center for Responsive Politics. The problem is the RNC raised less money this July than in the same critical months of the last four presidential elections. It's still more than $27 million, which sounds like a lot, but about a third of it can't be used for campaigning. The RNC has less than half the cash on hand than it did at this point in 2012.
They're going to have to make some pretty cold, calculated judgments about where they have potential to be successful in November and states where they're just not going to be competitive.
Republicans have less to spend on things like state-level staff and voter outreach, which are expensive. Here's Republican National Committee Chair Reince Priebus explaining on CBS.
I need to know everything about a particular voter, how to move them, but then I need to make sure that I put an absentee ballot or an early vote procedure in the hands of the people that I need to vote.
Less money at the top also means there's less to spend down ballot. Diana Dwyer is a political science professor at California State University, Chico.
So given that the Republicans are struggling to raise the kind of money they usually raise for a presidential election at the RNC level, the National Committee level, I doubt they're going to be getting too engaged in the House and Senate races.
The House and the Senate have their own party fundraising committees, but even those aren't raising as much money this election.
The Democrats are outraising the Republicans, which, you know, if you had said that 15 years ago, I think people would have been shocked. But the tables have turned a little bit.
So, like any business, Republicans have to find a way to stay competitive, either by raising more money or by using cheap labor, which in presidential elections go by the title campaign volunteers. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
While Congress enjoys its summer break, a vacation they left on, by the way, without deciding how or whether to fund a Zika prevention bill, mosquitoes in South Florida keep on doing what mosquitoes do. There are travel warnings up for parts of Miami. Florida Governor Rick Scott has scheduled a trip to Washington after Labor Day to try to get Congress to focus on this. Dr. Peter Daszak, though, is a disease ecologist. He's the president of the nonprofit EcoHealth Alliance. He's been studying diseases like Zika for 20 years, and he believes they can be stopped. So we got him on the phone the other day, and I asked him, first of all, what's to be done about Zika and Miami?
Well, without a doubt, we need to deal with the current crisis, and it will be a crisis. You know, pandemics are pretty inevitable in the way we spread. We can predict those patterns of spread. But once they're here, you've got cases, you've got people who have to go to the hospital. It's going to cost money, and we've got to try and deal with it and reduce the number of cases. But what I'm saying is we also need to get ahead of the curve. Let's actually spend some funds right now getting ready for what's coming next. We know what wildlife carry these pathogens. We know where they are on the planet. We know who really is going to be the first to get infected. Let's build capacity in those hotspot countries, and let's have a global virome project that identifies every potential threat.
You have said in the past that once we get to the point we're at now with an infectious disease, where it's a crisis, it's basically already too late. You got to get out in front of these things. The question to you then is, how do you do that?
What we're trying to do is just understand more about the problem. I mean, I think it's crazy that we just sit here and kind of wait for these things to happen, and then they hit us, and we have this huge economic loss as well as mortality events. And then we respond to it. We've got to get ahead of the curve on these things.
Well, and you actually, the EcoHealth Alliance, you have a predictive mapping system, I guess, where you can find the hotspots and say, yeah, it's probably going to be here and it's going to be there. Tell me about that.
We predict there's about 1.3 million unknown viruses that have the potential to infect people. So we produced a map. We analyzed all previous emerging diseases. There's about 500 of them. What we find are two major factors. First of all, where humans are doing things to the environment more and more, and where there are lots of wildlife species that carry unknown viruses. They're the hot spots for emerging diseases. They tend to be developing countries in the tropics. But because we're so globalized, these things just emerge and spread really rapidly. I just think that in 50 years' time, people will look back and say, wow, the end of the pandemic era. Those guys really had a problem with pandemics. They didn't face up to it until then. And once they did, they dealt with them.
Do you actually believe that, though? I mean, because it's so tempting to just, if it's not right in front of our faces, we as a species like to put our fingers in our ears and go, la, 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 and not deal with it. I mean, look at climate change, for crying out loud.
If you look at some numbers, look, we're talking economics, $3 to $7.3 trillion if we get a severe pandemic flu outbreak, 5 to 12.5% loss of GDP, and 70 to 142 million deaths. That's devastating to our global population. Climate change is going to be severe in the future, but these pandemics are hitting us right here and now. And you've only got to look at Ebola to say that's a complete breakdown of law and order. So I think we will deal with it.
It has to be cheaper to fight it in advance, right? To do the predictive expenditures versus doing it reactive and, you know, just to pick Ebola again, sending all that money and men and material and resources to a place after it's already a crisis.
I think it is going to be cost effective. In fact, we did some number crunching on this, and we estimate it'll be 10 times return on investment for a preventive program. Now, to prevent all of them is going to be a real tough challenge, but just preventing 10% would save us billions of dollars over the next few years.
Peter Daszak is the president of the environmental health nonprofit. It's called EcoHealth Alliance. Peter, thanks very much for your time.
Great talking to you, Kai.
Coming up.
There's only 50 times you can teach somebody how to wash their hands.
How many NGOs is too many NGOs? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off at 10% today, 33 points, closed at 18,448. The NASDAQ also down at 10%, 5 points, 52.12. For the trifecta here, yes, the S&P 500 gave back a 10%, 2 points, 21 and 72. You didn't want to have dollar in your name today. Dollar General got creamed after a lousy quarterly report. Shares down nearly 18%. Dollar Tree, no money growing there. Took a 10% hit for the same reason. The company said despite low gas prices and improving wages, consumers are still squeezed. Why, you ask? Rising healthcare costs, which gets us to the outrage over the price of the EpiPen. Mylan down another 0.6% today after its share price has been falling for 3, 4, 5 days. Now the focus on drug pricing hurt other big healthcare players too. Merck down 0.6%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Singer, songwriter, rapper, and R&B guy Frank Ocean released his first new album in 4 years this past weekend. Blonde, it's called. But that wasn't all. In the style of Beyonce and Lemonade this spring, there was a visual album as well and an art magazine, which you could buy at one of the Frank Ocean pop-up shops that appeared here in the U.S. and in the U.K. So a new normal for the music industry, perhaps? Wesley Morris is the culture critic at the New York Times. He is who we call to talk about stuff like this. Wesley, good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, Kai. What's happening?
Well, lots, but, you know, we'll talk about some other stuff, too. Frank Ocean and this, you have to call it a product release, right? I mean, it was a big whole smash, this thing was.
Yeah, yeah. And so good, in fact, that it got you to read some of it
on
the air.
I know.
That was the highlight of my week.
Well, I just for those who might have missed it, it was the McDonald's Man poem by Kanye West, which was in Frank Ocean's zine. Or is it zine or magazine? What do you think?
I don't think we should be calling it a zine.
Right,
a zine
okay.
is a tiny, like, insignificantly produced thing that means a lot to a lot of people.
Right.
But that was not a zine. This Boys Don't Cry is a coffee table behemoth.
Okay, so let me ask you then the question I should have started with 45 seconds ago. How an album drops today, and when I say album, I mean the whole smash, the visual album, the magazine, all this, how it mm-hmm. drops today sort of influences how it is received. Does that stand the smell test for you?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I see this as a critic. It's much harder to practice criticism on something whose mere existence, and I mean all of its existence, means so much to so many people and whose arrival was so breathlessly anticipated. I don't think anybody knew they were going to get all the stuff they got. They got a 45-minute video right. of Frank Ocean woodworking. They got this 300-page beautifully produced magazine, and they got an album on top of that, like as a bonus. They actually got two albums because
right.
Endless comes with a soundtrack.
Endless, the film, the visual album, is actually scored, I guess. What do you make, though, of this whole idea of a visual album?
I just liked it better when they called a music video. I don't
know. I was going to ask that, but I figured you would dump on me for that.
No, of course I wouldn't dump on you for that. They're videos. I mean, these aren't new concepts. I think that the immediacy, the suddenness of their arrival is what's new.
Do you think, though, now that people who really want to have an impact, and I'm talking, you know, top-rank artists like Beyonce, like Frank Ocean, like all these folks, do they have to now do this entire package?
No. I think that what real power to me is going to look like now is somebody who can just release a record and have it capture the nation's attention.
Huh.
I think that's where we're going back to. I think I don't want to call all of these things stunts. I think they are exercises in power, right?
Wow.
You want to know how much power you've commanded yep. or you can command in this version of your pop star self. And I think the hilarious line to get into that magazine.
Yeah, apparently it was crazy, right?
It was. I got to the line and I was just like, good luck, y'all. I'll just wait and get a copy from somebody at work.
Oh, that's too funny. Last thing on the way out here. What did you think of the music?
Okay, so my thing is, this is a very introverted artist, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that a lot of what's interesting about this record, or a lot of what's disappointingly interesting about this record is the way he obscures himself. He just distorts his voice. He does interesting things with it. You get a lot of music, but you don't get very many songs. And I've listened to it now about, I don't know, maybe a dozen times. And I don't have that kind of chills down my spine.
Yep.
Thing that I had with Channel Orange.
Right. Wesley Morris writes on culture and a bunch of other stuff at the New York Times. Thanks, man.
Thank you, Kai.
There is, not far from Nairobi, the capital of Kenya, a slum where hundreds of thousands of people live. It's called Kibera. And since 2000, with the rise of HIV and post-election violence in that country, it has become an almost fashionable place for visiting heads of state or celebrities to visit for a tour and a quick photo op. It's also become a high-profile spot that foreign aid groups, NGOs, non-governmental organizations like to pour money and workers into, in theory, to make life better. Residents of Kibera, though, are skeptical. They think a lot of those groups are fly-by-night or exploiting them to raise money. So as Dan Bobkoff reports now from Nairobi, locals have found ways to get something out of it for themselves.
No one really knows how many NGOs are in Kibera these days. Sharon Ogala's estimate is as good as any.
So many.
She's 20, and I met her outside the hair salon she runs with her mom. I had heard that locals like Ogala are so tired of the hundreds of outside organizations that have come in the last decade, the residents are now demanding to be paid when groups try to get them to go to meetings or trainings. Around here, they call these stipends sitting allowances.
Trust me, no one will go without that sitting allowance.
Do you think people go to hear about the organization, or do they go to get the fee?
Well, both, but mostly, honestly, the fee.
Time is money. We have no time to waste.
Ken Okoth grew up in Kibera, then became a member of parliament for the region. Millions of dollars have poured in since the early 2000s, but many here say only a few NGOs, like Doctors Without Borders, do real good for the community. Okoth says the vast majority don't have much to offer.
There's only 50 times you can teach somebody how to wash their hands. We have NGOs calling people, come in Kibera, we teach you the importance of hand washing. So if I'm broke and bored, I'll come listen to you.
Roughly 4 in 5 NGOs are thought to pay these sitting fees. They can range from about $1 to $3 an hour. Not bad money here. The groups that don't pay often find locals storm out when they learn they're not getting any cash. Some here get by on these handouts. There's a name for those people, professional attendees.
I know the professional attendees. I celebrate their ingenuity of taking advantage of people who've come to take advantage of them.
A few years ago, Ibrahim Maina was one of them.
Hey, Mambo.
These days, he's over the whole professional attendee life. He has a real job, as it happens, working for one of the few groups that does not pay the sitting fees. He thinks the handouts have created a culture of dependency.
They only wake up in the morning, they want to know where is the workshop, where are the meetings, because these NGOs have spoiled like their mind.
I wanted to see this dynamic in action, so I asked Maina to find me a meeting.
You have a meeting.
He sends some text messages. He gets the details, and we set off. Past the young woman singing in the street and the crowd dancing in the early afternoon. Through a slapdash metropolis made of corrugated iron. Past the butchers, hotels, dry cleaners, medical clinics, a place selling cell phones and office supplies.
Everything is here.
And then finally, we stop at a 2-story building. The sign out front reads, Pee Poople. It's an NGO. And it just so happens.
We advocate strongly on hand washing.
Hand washing. Medina Abakar works for Pee Poople, a group offering biodegradable toilets. They hold meetings nearly every day where they teach hygiene. Yes, she says, they pay the locals to come.
Yeah, you see, when you ask people to come to your meeting, they leave all their businesses and they come to the meeting. So you've wasted their time, so you have to balance the situation.
She won't let us stay for the meeting. Donors are visiting. Many Kibereans say they'd like some groups to leave. But dig deeper, and it's more complicated. It's become an NGO economy. They provide jobs as well as cash. But some people resent the system. And as if to underline that, as I'm leaving, a woman in the distance yells something in Swahili in my direction. My translator laughs and says she assumed I was from yet another NGO and told me to, quote, take my condoms back to Sweden. Hey, she saw a foreigner? And with so many groups here, it wasn't the worst guess. In Nairobi, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which I'm not entirely sure how I feel. Ryan Lochte lost all his big sponsorship deals after his idiocy down in Brazil during the Olympics, as you know. Speedo, Polo Ralph Lauren, and others dropped him like a hot potato. Today, though, Pine Brothers cough drops signed him up. Quote, just as Pine Brothers is forgiving to your throat, the company asks the public for a little forgiveness for an American swimming legend. End of quote. Cheesy and opportunistic all at once. Hey, ho, look at the time. We got to go. The Dow off a 10th percent today, 33 points. The NASDAQ also down a 10th, 5 points. S&P 500 down a 10th, 2 points there. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.